length about on One Step Beyond, the show that usually occupies roughly this time slot. It really, just through pure serendipity, has dovetailed very nicely with what's going on the national scene. One of the outcroppings, and of course at this point one of the angles that's most being hushed up about the Iran/Contra affair is the involvement of the Contras in running drugs to support their quote revolutionary effort unquote, and besides the Contras, the American intelligence establishment and military establishments themselves being involved in the dealing of drugs and the drugs for weapons for political power circle that goes all the way through North and South America, as well as a lot of other places, of course. But for our purposes tonight and our purposes in the Contra scandal, primarily we're interested in the North, South, and Central American links. So this is extremely timely. We talked several weeks ago about the fact that the Kerry Commission, among others, the Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, are apparently hard at work trying to break the facade of the Contra cocaine dealing scam. Again, a particularly interesting thing to know about at the time when we're being hammered with a, quote, just say no mentality. We're being told that if we were good citizens, we wouldn't mind submitting to urinalysis and things of this nature to protect our jobs, our livelihoods. Just recently, the scheme has gone through for federal employees. It's currently being held up in court, but the Federal Employees Union is not objecting on moral grounds. They're objecting on very specific grounds about the efficacy of the tests and things of that nature. So it's very important to all citizens to realize, on one hand, while the government with one hand is holding the bottle underneath you or before you, on the other hand, the government also seems to be dealing smack in cocaine right and left. And it's very important to understand how this developed and what purpose it serves in today's political milieu.
Now, the first of our broadcasts in Radio Free, that is to say, the first of our archive shows specifically about this subject, we documented how the U.S. intelligence services, the CIA in particular, gave rise in considerable measure to the international heroin trade in the post-World War II era by employing many of its primary elements, such as the Sicilian Cosa Nostra, the Union Chorus of the organized crime syndicate of Corsica and Marseille, in an anti-communist capacity, and the further alliance between the U.S. National Security Establishment and various elements of the Kuomintang, which had been using the opium traffic to finance reaction, political reaction in Asia for quite some time. The dovetailing of those organizations in many ways led to the booming of the post-World War II heroin trade. In our second broadcast, we documented the close interrelationship between the international arms trade, our intelligence services, and the international drug trade. In the last broadcast on this subject, we began going into the, in fact, we did cover, among other things, the use of elements of the Federal Narcotics Prevention Force to, in fact, selectively enforce who was going to be trafficking in the major narcotics areas, specifically heroin. We took a look at how the DEA and a special White House special White House assassination team to be used supposedly to clean up the international drug trade was in fact used to muscle the Corsicans out of the trade in favor of a number of organized crime syndicates, primarily mafia in this country, which were very close to Richard Nixon. We also took a look during the course of that last broadcast at the dovetailing, and also to a certain extent in the Radio Free America number 25, at the dovetailing of many of these international drug smuggling syndicates with not only our own intelligence system, but also with right-wing terror, in particular CIA and U.S. National Security Establishment-sponsored terror in Latin America. That's where we're going to be picking up again this evening. The broadcast this evening could very appropriately be titled as it could be titled with the subtitle of a book which we're going to rely on in considerable measure on this broadcast, as we have in others. The book is called The Great Heroin Coup, subtitled Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism. It was authored by freelance Danish journalist Henrik Kruger, K-R-U-G-E-R, with a foreword by Peter Dale Scott, published in soft cover by the South End Press, and copyrighted 1980. And the broadcast this evening, which will rely in considerable measure on The Great Heroin Coup, could very well be titled Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism. In fact, probably at Davcor, that's exactly what it'll be titled. And what we're going to be talking about this evening is the triad of the U.S. national security establishment, the CIA in particular, the narcotics trafficking elements that we've spoken of in the past, and right-wing terror, in particular right-wing terror in Latin America.
All right, starting out with tonight's rather, as Dave said, rather extensive selections from the great heroin coup by Heinrich Krüger. Meyer Lansky, the syndicate's financial wizard and its chairman from around 1947, began building his Cuban empire in the early 40s, when free elections chased his close friend and dictator Fulgencio Batista from office in 1944, Lansky also left the island, entrusting his empire to the Traficante family, headed by Santo Sr. Lansky and Batista settled in Hollywood, Florida, just north of Miami. Before long, Lansky was running an illegal casino empire on the coast, and in 1947 he eliminated Bugsy Siegel and moved into Las Vegas. All the while, Lansky expanded the narcotics trade founded by Lucky Luciano. The older mafia dons deemed the trade taboo, so Lansky's wing of the syndicate cornered the market, with Traficante's eldest son, Santo Jr., overseeing the heroin traffic. When Florida's illegal casinos were shut down in 1950, Lansky promoted Batista's return to power in Cuba. The drive bore fruit in 1952. With Traficante Sr.'s death in 1954, Santo Jr. became Lansky's right-hand man and manager of his Cuban interests. Until then, he had managed the Sans Souci Casino, a base for running Havana's tourist trade and keeping tabs on heroin shipments from Marseille to New York via Florida and Cuba. Traficante Jr. has proven more talented than his father. Extraordinarily intelligent and energetic, he has handled the most acute crises with detached calm. Luciano characterized him as, quote, a guy who always managed to hug the background, but he is rough and reliable. In fact, he's one of the few guys in the whole country that Meyer Lansky would never tangle with. In no time, Traficante Jr. ingratiated himself with dictator Batista while remaining loyal to Lansky, who appointed him manager of his own Florida interests in addition to those in Cuba. Lansky needed to spend increasing amounts of time in New York between travels to Las Vegas, Rome, Marseille, Beirut, and Geneva. Many envied Lansky's ever-increasing power and wealth, among them Murder, Inc. chairman of the board, Albert Anastasia. In 1957, the latter tried enlisting Traficante's aid in removing Lansky from the Havana scene. It was one of Anastasia's last moves. Traficante arranged a, quote, friendly meeting in New York's Sheraton Hotel. An hour after Traficante had checked out, Anastasia was murdered in the hotel's barbershop, shaving cream still on his face. According to Peter Dale Scott, quote, certain U.S. business interests collaborated with the narcotics-linked American mafia in Cuba, as they did with similar networks in China and later in Vietnam, for the mafia supplied the necessary local intelligence, cash, and muscle against the threat of communist takeover, unquote. As Scott wrote those words in 1973, Cuban Americans recruited by the CIA were suspected by federal and city authorities to be, quote, involved in everything from narcotics to extortion rackets and bombings, unquote. The Church Committee and other Senate and law enforcement reports would confirm these allegations. Again, we observe the Cuba, Southeast Asia, CIA triangle, and it's no secret who managed the Cuban side. There, Traficante Jr. hired the fast-learning natives, while dictator Batista's men made the empire safe for organized crime, often appearing more loyal to Traficante than to Batista himself. In return, the Cubans learned the business.
With Fidel Castro's January 1, 1959 ouster of Batista, Lansky and Traficante were in trouble. Though they were expelled from their Cuban kingdom, nearly a year elapsed before the syndicate departed and the casinos were closed. Along with Traficante and Lansky, 500,000 Cubans left the island in the years following Castro's takeover. Some 100,000 settled in the New York City area, especially Manhattan's Washington Heights and New Jersey's Hudson County. Another 100,000 headed to Spain, others to Latin America, and 250,000 made their new home in Florida, the site of Traficante's new headquarters. Out of the Traficante-trained corps of Cuban officers, security staffers, and politicians, a Cuban mafia emerged under the mobster's control. It specialized in narcotics, first Latin American cocaine, then Marseille heroin. With his Cubans, Traficante also grabbed control of La Bolita, the numbers game that took Florida by storm and became a syndicate gold mine. Besides the Cubans, who comprised the main wing of his organization, Trafficante also worked closely with the non-Italian Harlan Blackburn mob, a break with mafia tradition. But the core of the Trafficante family remained Italian, and the Italians also dealt in drugs. In 1960, his man Benedito Benny the Cringe Indiviglio, Indiviglio, negotiated the opening of a narcotics route with Jacques L'Americain, the representative of Corsican boss Joseph Orsini. Benedetto and his brothers Romano, Arnold, Charles, and Frederick eventually ran Trafficante's Montreal-bound smuggling network and were later joined by the notorious New York wholesaler Louis Cirillo. Trafficante settled in Tampa, but continued to run some of his activities from Jimmy Hoffa's Teamster Local 320 in Miami. Trafficante and David Yaris of Sam Giancana's Chicago mob were instrumental in founding Local 320, which, according to the McClellan hearings, was a front for syndicate narcotics activities. After losing his Havana paradise, far-sighted Meyer Lansky used straw men to buy up much of Grand Bahama Island and erected a new gambling center around the city of Nassau. But though Lansky and Trafficante each survived in style, neither they nor the Cuban exiles relinquished hope of a return to Cuba. Moreover, they were not alone in dreaming of overthrowing Castro. The CIA in particular let its imagination run wild to this end. Its covert operations expert, General Edward Lansdale, seriously planned to send a submarine to the shore outside Havana, where it would create an inferno of light. At the same time, Cuba-based agents would warn the religious natives of the second coming of Christ and the Savior's distaste for Fidel Castro. However, elimination by illumination, unquote, was shelved in favor of less fantastic suggestions for Castro's assassination. The latter brought together the CIA, Cuban exiles, and the syndicate in the person of Santo Trafficante.
Continuing with Henry Krueger's The Great Heroin Coup. In 1960, the CIA asked its contract agent Robert Mayhew to contact the mobster John Rosselli. Rosselli introduced Mayhew to Trafficante and Sam Giancana, the Chicago capo, and the strange bedfellows arranged an attempt on the life of Castro. The agency had previously stationed an agent on Cuba who was to flash the green light when assassination opportunities arose. He was Frank Angelo Fiorini, a one-time smuggler of weapons to Castro's Revolutionary Army, to whom Castro had entrusted the liquidation of the gambling casinos. Through the later assignment, Fiorini had made the acquaintance of Trafficante. In February 1961, Trafficante and Rosselli met at Miami's Fontainebleau Hotel. There, Mayhew gave the hoods untraceable poison capsules for delivery to a Cuban exile connected with the Trafficante mob. Other Cubans were to smuggle them to the island and poison Castro. But the attempt failed. Trafficante engineered more attempts, including one in September 1962, and his organization also provided Cubans for the Bay of Pigs invasion. Never before had there existed a more remarkable, fanatical group of conspirators than that assembled to create, finance, and train the Bay of Pigs invasion force. The top CIA figures were Lansdale protege Napoleon Valeriano, the mysterious Frank Bender, and E. Howard Hunt, who was himself involved in at least one of the attempts on Fidel Castro's life. They were supported by a small army of CIA operatives from four of its Miami cover firms. By the way, we should just mention the Frank Fiorini mentioned earlier is Frank Sturgis, later
right.
known of Watergate fame and also a close working companion of E. Howard Hunt in many other operations. Runner-up to Hunt for the Most Intriguing CIA Conspirator Award is Bender, a German refugee whose true identity remains a matter of speculation. Some contend that he had been an agent of the West German Galen espionage network under the name Drecker, D-R-E-C-H-E-R. Others contend it was Droller, D-R-O-L-L-E-R. The former security chief for Dominican Republic dictator Rafael Trujillo claims that Bender was in fact one Fritz Schwend, or they spell it here S-W-E-N-T, Schwend, a Galen collaborator and leader of ex-Nazis in Peru. Prior to the Bay of Pigs invasion, Schwend was allegedly the CIA's man in the Dominican Republic as Don Frederico. There he purportedly planned the invasion along with mobster Frank Costello and ex-Cuban dictator Batista. Okay, before we get back to that, let me just run back over that name before we finish up this section. Okay, this man is going to be very important in our broadcast tonight. Fritz or Freddy Svend or Schwend. It's either spelled, last name either spelled S-W-E-N-D or S-C-H-W-E-N-D. Fritz or Freddy Schwend, also known as Don Frederico, a Galen collaborator and a leader of the ex-Nazis in Peru. He's going to be loom very important in our broadcast tonight. Among other things he was involved in was the Rat Line, using the proceeds, the profits from the counterfeiting operation Bernhardt, the SS operation, to finance the Rat Line to get Nazis out of Europe. Also, the Vatican and the CIA, the Vatican and military intelligence helped out with that one. So Freddy Schwend, presumably also a.k.a. Frank Bender, one of the planners of the Bay of Pigs operation.
We went into Frederick Schwend, his association with the CIA, the Rat Line, and Klaus Barbie in Radio Free America number 19, the third of our programs about the Vatican politics, the P2 Lodge, and the assassination of Pope John Paul II.
The invasion's moral and financial supporters included many leading China lobbyists. Most important was the multimillionaire behind Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers, William Pauley. P-A-W-L-E-Y. Pauley had been involved in the CIA's 1954 overthrow of Guatemala's democratically elected Arbenz regime. Like Lansky and Traficante, Pauley had a big stake in Cuba. Prior to Castro's takeover, he had owned the Havana bus system and sugar refineries. He met with President Eisenhower several times in 1959 to persuade the president to assist Cuban exiles in overthrowing Castro. Pauley then helped the CIA recruit anti-Castro Cubans. It should be mentioned a couple of other key players in the 1954 Guatemalan coup that overthrew the Arbenz regime. Not only the aforementioned E. Howard Hunt, but one of the pilots involved in training people for the 1954 coup in Guatemala was a man by the name of David Ferry, who, according to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, was the first man that should be looked at in reopening an investigation into a conspiracy in the John F. Kennedy assassination. David Ferry, of course, not being around to be looked at in the flesh after a mysterious accident took his life, but one of the most important and strange people in American political history, also involved in that 1954 Guatemalan operation. And the contact here, not only between the mafia and the CIA, but then the CIA and the anti-Castro Cubans, is going to form a thread not only running through all our drug stuff tonight, but it runs directly from Guatemala to Cuba to the Kennedy assassination to Watergate and right on up into the Contra scam today.
And also through the other assassinations as well. We took a look at a fellow named Jack Youngblood, his cooperation with Frank Fiorini, a.k.a. Frank Sturgis, and in turn Jack Youngblood's probable subsequent involvement in the assassination of Martin Luther King. Continuing now with Henry Krueger's account of the triad of the CIA, right-wing terror, and organized crime involving the narcotics traffic, and eventually, as we're going to look at this evening, a series of right-wing terrorist operations in Latin America. The key Cuban exile conspirators in the Bay of Pigs operation and the ensuing attacks on Cuba and Castro included Manuel Artime, Orlando Bosch — Bosch is an important character, we're going to come back to him — Felipe de Diego, and Rolando Martinez. The first, a close friend of Howard Hunt's, the last two, future Watergate burglars. The name of Bosch, B-O-S-C-H, was to become synonymous with terrorism. Distinguishing the non-criminal element among the Bay of Pigs' anti-Castro Cubans is no easy matter, since so many emerged from Traficante's Cuban mafia. According to agents of the BNDD, that was the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, a predecessor of the DEA, beginning again, according to agents of the BNDD, nearly 10% of the 1,500-man force had been or eventually were arrested for narcotics violations. Its recruiters included syndicate gangsters like Richard Kane, the former Chicago policeman who became a lieutenant for Sam Giancana. The Dominican Republic, a focal point in the invasion scheme, also became a transit point for Traficante's narcotics traffic. Furthermore, the CIA, according to agents of the BNDD, helped organize the drug route by providing IDs and speedboats to former Batista officers in the Dominican Republic in charge of narcotics shipments to Florida. It is of paramount importance to note the close CIA cooperation with Traficante's Cuban mafia, whose overriding source of income was the smuggling of drugs. One of Traficante's personal CIA contacts for the Bay of Pigs was Frank Fiorini, Castro's liquidator of mob casinos, who now preferred the name Frank Sturgis. In late 1960, Sturgis ran the Miami-based International Anti-Communist Brigade, IACB, said to be financed by the syndicate. According to Richard Whatley, W-H-A-T-T-L-E-Y, a brigade member hired for the invasion, quote, Traficante would order Sturgis to move his men, and he'd do it. Our ultimate conclusion was that Traficante was our backer. He was our money man, unquote. Another detail from Sturgis's past is especially interesting in light of Frank Bender's alleged ties to the Galen organization. For a period in the early 50s, Sturgis was involved in espionage activities in Berlin, serving as a courier between various nations' intelligence agencies, and was thereby inevitably in contact with the Galen network. The Bay of Pigs invasion was, of course, a fiasco, but that hardly stopped the CIA, the Syndicate, or their Cuban exile troops. Wheels were soon turning on new assassination attempts under CIA agent William Harvey, who again collaborated with the underworld. Within months, the Miami CIA station JM Wave was again in full swing. It sponsored a series of hit-and-run attacks on strategic Cuban targets that spanned 3 years and involved greater manpower and expenditures than the Bay of Pigs invasion itself.
Continuing. To head the JM Wave station, the CIA chose one of its up-and-coming agents, the 34-year-old Theodore Shackley, who came direct from Berlin. His closest Cuban exile associates were Joaquin Sangenis and Rolando Watergate Burglary Martinez. Some 300 agents and 4,000 to 6,000 Cuban exile operatives took part in the actions of JM Wave. As later revealed, one of its last operations was closed down because one of its aircraft was caught smuggling narcotics into the United States. Okay, now pay special attention to the part coming up, because Theodore Shackley, not only involved in several of the things we talked about, came up in our assassination attempt on the Pope series, but of course he is now one of the key players in the current Contra/Iran scam.
He is also one of the major members of the Turbo Wilson team, which has come back into focus in a big way during the Iran-Contra-Gate scam. Edwin Wilson himself was a paymaster for the Bay of Pigs. We also looked at Theodore Shackley in Radio Free America number 12, where we analyzed what we referred to as the Cuban Fry Corps, basically an underground extension of the military put together by JM Wave and apparently involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. And we're going to be repeating in this broadcast certain sections from that program, and we're taking a look in particular now at the organized crime narcotic smuggling elements of the Cuban Fry Corps.
Continuing, Theodore Shackley is another contender for the Most Intriguing CIA Conspirator Award. After years of collaboration with Traficante organization Cubans, he and part of his Miami staff were transferred to Laos, where he joined Lucien Conein, C-O-N-E-I-N. There they helped organize the CIA's secret Mayo Tribesmen Army, the second such army drummed up by Shackley that was up to its ears in the drug traffic. Vientiane, where Shackley was the station chief, became the new center of the heroin trade. For those of you who don't know, of course, Vientiane is the capital of Laos. Later, he ran the station in Saigon, where the traffic flowed under the profiteering administration of Premier Nguyen Cao Ky. When the agency prepared its coup against the Chilean President Salvador Allende, Shackley was its chief of covert operations in the Western Hemisphere. When William Colby became the director of the CIA in 1973, Shackley took over his job as chief of covert operations in the Far East. Eventually, he was booted out of the agency as part of the shakeup ordered by its current director, Stansfield Turner. By the way, one of the reasons that supposedly, and this is all rather unclear still, but one of the reasons, of course, that he was supposedly booted out of the agency was because he was caught in part of the Ed Wilson, Frank Turpel weapons shipment scams that, of course, many people since then, Dave and myself included, have suggested were not, in fact, extra-legal at all. Well, it might have been extra-legal, but they were not extra-agency. They were, in fact, part of the agency's policy, and that throwing them out of the agency never stopped their actual involvement with agency plans. Stansfield Turner, I don't know, he may have thought that that's what he was doing, but in practice he proves to have been either naive or just plain wrong or a liar, one of the three. Anyway, continuing now with Shackley and what happened to Shackley and the JM Wave operation. In the JM Wave period, a great expansion in China Lobby, Traficante, Cuban exile, CIA connections occurred. William Pauley financed a mysterious summer 1963 boat raid against Cuba in his own yacht, the Flying Tiger II. Besides Pauley himself, the crew included mafioso John Martino, who had operated roulette wheels in one of Traficante's Havana casinos, CIA agents codenamed Rip, Mike, and Ken, ubiquitous Rolando Martinez, and a dozen other Cuban exiles led by Eddie Bayo and Eduardo Perez, many of whom eventually disappeared mysteriously. Lauren Hall, L-O-R-E-N, Lauren Hall, another former Traficante casino employee, claimed that both his boss and Sam Giancana had helped plan the raid. Claire Booth Luce, a queen pin of the China lobby, testified during Senate hearings on the CIA that she had financed an exile gunboat raid on Cuba after JFK had ordered the agency to halt such raids. Now, you remember we talked about very briefly about how these threads extend out in every single direction. Lauren Hall, mentioned here, is one of the people who was a former Traficante casino employee, also has a rather interesting history, and he's come up in previous One Step Beyond in Radio Free Americas.
Specifically, in the aforementioned Radio Free America number 12, dealing with the Cuban Fry Corps and its role in the assassination of President Kennedy and its connections to the Aryan Nations neo-Nazi umbrella group up in Hayden Lake, Idaho, We talked about Lauren Hall, we talked about the Cuban Fry Corps, and specifically we talked about Lauren Hall's connections with Edgar Eugene Bradley. We talked about how Lauren Hall was interviewed by then Reagan legal counselor Edwin Meese, currently the Attorney General of the United States. And it's interesting, too, that in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy, in our last Radio Free America show, we talked about an organized crime and narcotic smuggling group called The Company, quote-unquote, which appears to have quite possibly have had some intersections with the company, quote-unquote, namely the CIA. Specifically, we took a look at allegations by one of the hitmen used to a man named Charles Harrison, used to assassinate a federal judge in Texas. That said, we looked at his claim to have been one of the hitmen in the assassination of President Kennedy. We also took a look at an interesting series of connections connecting Charles Harrelson with, among others, Jack Ruby and organized crime figures associated with Santos Traficante. We also, by the way, dealt with Santos Traficante in Guns of November program number 1, and we're going to reprise some of the information, not specifically, but some of the organized crime connections to the Kennedy assassination are going to come into focus here in just a second. The real key element here, though, is station JM Wave, which, as former CIA agent Ray Klein said, was basically run like a covert operation abroad, although it was based in the United States. JM Wave was basically used to unite a lot of far right-wing elements and to bring them under the umbrella of the U.S. National Security Establishment. It's worth noting here, too, as we talk about some of the Galen connections, and the Galen and World Anti-Communist League connections we're going to be coming into later, that Theodore Shackley went to the station JM Wave directly from Berlin. And we know what was going on there at this period of time. Continuing now with Henry Krueger's The Great Heroin Coup. I will not wander deeply into the quagmire of circumstances surrounding the murder of President John F. Kennedy. However, it is worth repeating a few lines from the final report of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Quote, "The committee's extensive investigation led to the conclusion that the most likely family bosses of organized crime to have participated in such a unilateral assassination plan were Carlos Marcello and Santo Traficante." Unquote. Of the many connections between Traficante and Dallas, the most important are his association with Jack Ruby, who visited him in a Havana prison in 1959. His statement to Cuban exile financier Jose Alamán that Kennedy, quote, "is going to be hit," unquote, and his close association with fellow Mafia capo Carlos Marcello. The Cuban exiles, drug racketeers, and the CIA had no shortage of anti-Kennedy motives, which were all the more intensified as the three forces gradually welded together. The anti-Cuba actions continued well into 1965, at which time a crucial three-year turnabout for the Lansky Syndicate began. Its money had been invested in the unsuccessful attempt at toppling Castro, and in its new casino complex in Nassau, which was threatened by local anti-gambling forces. So when Southeast Asia began emerging as a new heroin export center, Lansky sent his financial expert John Pullman to check out the opportunities for investment. Close on his heels went Frank Furci, F-U-R-C-I, the son of a Traficante lieutenant. From 1968 on, Traficante's Cubans were in effective control of the traffic in heroin and cocaine throughout the United States. The Florida capo's only gangland partner of significance was the Catroni family in Montreal. Trafficante carried out his business in a cool and collected manner. Never out of line with the national syndicate, he enjoyed relative anonymity while other, less prominent gangsters wrote their names in history with blood. His organization was so airtight that when narcotics investigators finally realized how big a fish he was, they had to admit he was untouchable. The BNDD tried nabbing him in its 1969-70 Operation Eagle, then the most extensive action ever directed against a single narcotics network. The Bureau arrested over 120 traffickers, wholesalers, and pushers, but made no real dent. Within days, well-trained Cubans moved into the vacated slots.
To the BNDD's surprise, a very large number of those arrested in Operation Eagle were CIA-trained veterans of the Bay of Pigs and Operation 40. Among them were Juan César Restoy, R-E-S-T-O-Y, a former Cuban senator under Batista, Alan Eric Rudd Marrero, last name R-U-D-D hyphen M-A-R-R-E-R-O, a pilot, and Mario Escandar. Their fates were most unusual. Escandar and Restoy, alleged leaders of the narcotics network, were arrested in June 1970, but fled from Miami City Jail in August. Escandar turned himself in, but was released soon afterward when it was established that Attorney General John Mitchell had neglected to sign the authorization for the wiretap that incriminated Escandar. He returned to narcotics and was arrested in 1978 for kidnapping, a crime punishable by life, but for which he got only 6 months. As this work went to press, the FBI was investigating Escandar's relationship with the Dade County, Miami police force. Juan Restoy, on the other hand, turned to blackmail. He threatened to expose a close friend of President Nixon's as a narcotics trafficker, if not given his freedom, and $350,000. Restoy was shot and killed by narcotics agents, as was Rudd Marrero. In late 1970, in the wake of Operation Eagle, Bay of Pigs veteran Guillermo Hernandez Cartaya set up the World Finance Corporation, WFC, a large company alleged to be a conduit for Trafficante investments and for the income from his narcotics activities. Duny Perez Alamo, a CIA-trained explosives expert involved with several Cuban exile terrorist groups, was a building manager for the WFC. Juan Romanac, R-O-M-A-N-A-C-H, a close Trafficante associate, was a WFC bank director. As Hank Messick put it, Hank Messick, by the way, is a writer who wrote a very good book called Of Grass and Snow, and a lot of the stuff that Henrik Krueger is talking about here came up originally in that book.
Also a very good book called Lansky, detailing Meyer Lansky and, among other things, Lansky's close association with Richard Nixon. In our last Radio Free America show, we talked about we read a chapter from The Great Heroine Coup called The Friends of Richard Nixon, which documented in rather compelling fashion the massive intersection between the Nixon presidency, well, in fact, the Nixon organization throughout the course of Richard Nixon's political career, and many of the organized crime and national security elements which are coming into focus in the present discussion.
Here's Hank Messick talking about the chain of personal friendship or business relationship. Hank Messick says, quote, Escandar, of course, was a friend of Hernandez Cartaya, who was a friend of Dick Fincher, who was a friend of Bebe Rebozo, who was a friend of Richard Nixon, who once told John Dean he could get $1 million in cash, unquote. In 1968, Trafficante himself went on an extended business trip to the Far East, beginning in Hong Kong, where he had located his emissary, Frank Furtze. After a slow 1965-66 start, Furtze had made great headway. Through his own Meridem Limited, he had cornered the market on Saigon's night spots catering to GIs. He even ran officer and soldier mess halls, and he had set up a chain of heroin labs in Hong Kong to serve the GI market. From Hong Kong, Trafficante journeyed to Saigon, registering at the Continental Palace Hotel, owned by the Corsican Franchini family. His last stop was Singapore, where he contacted a branch of the splintered Chinese mafia.
Several doors had to be opened to gain access to the opium treasure. The first led to the CIA-controlled Taiwan regime, the second to the Golden Triangle's Kuomintang Chinese and Laotian Mayo tribesmen. The latter door had already been opened by the CIA. So, by the way, had the former, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 24. Continuing now with Kruger's account. Still another led to the Triads, Chinese gangster organizations in Hong Kong. Trafficante opened that door with the help of Furci, F-U-R-C-I, who gave him access to Southeast Asia's overseas Chinese. There was no way around the nationalist Chinese suppliers and middlemen. The world had long been told that the narcotics came from Red China, but the facts belied that propaganda claim. Trafficante liked what he saw in his Southeast Asian tour. With enough trained chemists, his mob could be supplied with heroin at a fraction of what it was then paying out to the Corsicans. But first, the smuggling networks had to be worked out, and the Corsicans had to be eliminated. So Santo Trafficante began his war against the Corsicans. His major foe, Auguste Ricord in Paraguay, wasn't about to roll over and die. Ricord got hold of his own Hong Kong connection, Ng Sik Ho, N-G-S-I-K-H-O, also known as Limpy Ho, a major Chinese nationalist heroin smuggler well connected to the Taiwan regime. After Ricord's emissaries had traveled twice in 1970 to Japan, where they met with Mr. Ho, heroin shipments began going to Paraguay via, among other transit points, Chile. When in 1972 Ricord was extradited to the U.S., Limpy Ho tried establishing his own smuggling route to the U.S. via Vancouver. But that failed when two of his lieutenants, Sammy Cho and Chang Yu Ching, were arrested in the U.S. with 50 pounds of pure heroin. By early 1970, Southeast Asian-produced heroin was ready to be tested on GI guinea pigs. Meyer Lansky, facing charges of business illegalities, turned over control to Trafficante and fled to Israel. On July 4th, Lansky Narcotics Associates reportedly made their investment plans for Southeast Asia at a 12-day meeting with representatives of several mafia families at the Hotel Sole in Palermo, Sicily. Weeks later, the Corsican Mafia contemplated countermoves in a meeting at Philippe Franchini's suite in Saigon's Continental Palace Hotel. Turkish opium production was already waning and could no longer be relied upon. Unrest in the Middle East was destabilizing the production of morphine base. The Corsicans had to do something to regain control over their longtime Southeast Asian domain, a task made all but impossible by the U.S. presence. But the Corsicans still had large stocks of morphine, their Marseille labs, and a smoothly functioning smuggling network. Trafficante and company could agree that if the Corsicans were to be neutralized, it had to be done totally and effectively. That was a job for President Nixon and his White House staff, the BNDD White House Death Squad, and the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, we looked in our last broadcast at what Henry Krueger calls the Great Heroin Coup, and we're going to take a look at that here in just a second.
Okay, before we do that, since this seems like a nice place to break, and all of you out there with 90-minute tapes or whatever can turn them over here, we're going to take a short break for a few minutes, listen to a little music, give you a chance to let some of that preparatory material soak in. As we come back, as Dave said, we're going to talk about the coup itself and the changeover and the direct profiting thereby of the American intelligence establishment, and begin to thread together some of the connections that will make so much sense when you start reading the news again tomorrow morning, if you're not familiar with this stuff already. So we'll be back in just a couple of minutes after taking a break. Don't go away. We will return in a few minutes with more of, I'm having trouble talking tonight, with more of Radio Free America right here on KFJC. Thus we are returned. This is Nip Tuck with Dave Emery in the studios and Radio Free America continuing. And we've just been hearing the opening segment of the broadcast. Again, a large part of most of the first part of the broadcast, actually a large part of the broadcast entirely, is from Heinrich Krueger's The Great Heroin Coup, a wonderful book, South End Press, 1980 in paperback. If you can find a copy, get it and read it and carry it around with you and make other people read it. It's really a fine book.
And if you can't find a copy, we will have, by the time this broadcast is finished, put more than a third of the book on tape. So even if you can't dig up a copy, peruse these tapes at considerable length and detail, and you'll have an awful lot of the good material under your belt.
Now, we talked at the beginning of the broadcast, and in the course of putting this together, about two main things. Well, first of all, the specific subject matter from the Great Heroin Coup having to do with the Lansky mobs taking in hand the Cuban mafia, and with the help of Santo Traficante, Lansky's lieutenant and now his own man, with Lansky's passing from the scene, the Lansky mob basically took over a large part of the heroin trade. And at the same time, because of their involvement with the Cuban mafia and their involvement with the anti-Castro Cubans, came into direct contact with the CIA and the Bay of Pigs operation. And as we talked about, there's a thread of traffic going all the way from World War II and intelligence operations in World War II, starting actually during the war and continuing through the end of the war and getting the Nazis out of Europe and into Central and South America, and contacts made there through going on through there up through the 1954 coup in Guatemala, the Bay of Pigs invasion, the Dominican public incursion, the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 63, Robert Kennedy in 1968, Martin Luther King, Watergate, and right on up to today with the whole Iran scandal that has quote-unquote rocked the White House. But believe me, folks, that ain't nothing as to what is underneath, and which, if we're really lucky, some of this may break surface in the next few months, but we will see what we will see. But anyway, so there's a very direct line with what we're talking about tonight, dating clear back into the 40s. Some of the same players are still involved, like Theodore Shackley, today in the self-same Iran/Contra scam.
Now, what we're going to begin, what we're going to be doing right now, is reviewing a chapter which we read in its entirety, we're not going to review it, we're going to reprise a chapter which we had in the last Radio Free America broadcast, number 26. This details Henry Krueger's analysis of the Great Heroin Coup. Now, in a nutshell, the Nixon White House, closely allied, as we've just seen and as we looked at it in our last broadcast, with the Lansky Traficante heroin smuggling syndicate, and with the CIA, of course, which in turn intersects very heavily with the same aforementioned syndicate, basically they collaborated, and a fellow named Lucian Conin, part of the Shackley team and the operations group in Southeast Asia, put together a group of, quote, ex-CIA men, unquote, who then proceeded to dispatch many of the key people in the Corsican syndicate, and thereby handing the Traficante mob a corner on the heroin trade for all practical purposes in this country. In addition, as we're going to see, and this is in many ways going to represent the point of departure for the broadcast this evening, many of these same elements also appear to have been heavily involved in the bevy of right-wing terrorist incidents centering largely around anti-Castro Cubans, which plagued Latin America and other parts of the world in the 1970s and also on up into the 1980s. And the title for tonight's broadcast could be, as we said, in fact, will be, the subtitle of Henrik Krueger's book, Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism, The Great Heroin Coup, as Henrik Krueger put it, the use of the BNDD White House intelligence squad to corner the market for the Traficante mob is going to represent the, as I said, the point of departure for our study of the triad of intelligence, specifically the U.S. National Security Establishment, the narcotics traffic, and right-wing terror in Latin America and other places.
All right, continuing with Henrik Krueger writing about the central thesis of his book, The Coup Itself. This chapter, Krueger writes, contains my personal interpretation of the Great Heroin Coup. Errors are possible on any or all points, inasmuch as the clandestine operations treated in this book transpire in a closed world infested with lies and cover-ups. There will always be loose ends. The coup itself, which transferred control over the heroin gold mine from one part of the world to another, I regard as a fact of life. Similarly, do I regard the involvement of elements of the White House staff. Just how high up it went, the reader can decide for him or herself. Of the many heretofore mentioned details in the coup's planning and execution, I find the following essential. 1. Prior to the coup, Lansky Syndicate narcotics boss Santo Traficante Jr. had made the necessary arrangements in Southeast Asia and Mexico and had started a war with the Corsican Mafia. 2. Traficante's old partner, the CIA, had long since assumed control over Southeast Asia opium smuggling following Ed Lansdale and Lucien Conin's defeat of the local branch of the Corsican underworld. 3. In 1971, when the coup's execution was seriously underway, Cuban exiles, a group with which Traficante enjoyed a unique rapport, appeared in the White House's mysterious narcotics operation. They were tied especially to Conine and E. Howard Hunt. 4. Through a succession of bureaucratic reorganizations, the White House assumed control over narcotics intelligence and enforcement. 5. U.S. narcotics officials waged an all-out war against the Corsican's Turkey-Marseille USA network, while warning of a serious heroin threat. Number 5. U.S. narcotics officials waged an all-out war against the Corsican's Turkey-Marseille USA network, while warnings of a serious heroin threat from Southeast Asia were all but dismissed. 6. When the Corsican Mafia was neutralized, the narcotics enforcement apparatus was suddenly reorganized as the DEA, and shortly thereafter, heroin began flowing into the United States from Southeast Asia and Mexico. 7. The CIA infiltrated DEA, grabbed control of Latin America's political repression apparatus, was accused of protecting major narcotics dealers, and was exposed as an accomplice to gun running financed with the profits from the narcotics traffic. 8. The White House protected Robert Vesco, who appears to be a central figure in the scheme of heroin smuggling and gun running.